Operation Defend Europe, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Some European nationalists want to stop migrants from reaching the continent, and they've launched their own ship to make it happen.
The immigration, the Islamization, all those problems, it all starts at our borders in the Mediterranean Sea, and it needs to end there.
Also, we check in on one Syrian family that did make it to Europe. Our reporter catches up with them in Germany.
Can you imagine you'll ever feel German?
No, not Syrian, but maybe my children, they will be. My mother was Syrian. They will forget.
Plus, when Olive Yang was a kid in Burma.
She got in trouble for bringing guns in her backpack to school.
Just wait till you hear what she did when she got older. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for being here. It is summer, and for many of us, it's the time to slow down and relax. But for migrants in North Africa, summer is the time to flee if they can. The weather is warm and the sea isn't freezing. So every single day this time of year, several hundred people try to cross the Mediterranean from Libya, often on dangerously overcrowded boats. Many people drown doing this. We've reported on The World on the rescue ships that patrol the Mediterranean. Today we're going to hear about one group of far-right nationalists who are working in the opposite direction. They call themselves Defend Europe. Their goal is to intercept migrants and return them to the Libyan Coast Guard. And here's why, according to one member.
If you invite the whole of Africa, you don't help Africa, you become Africa. But we don't want to become Africa. And that's why we are not planning our vacations, but we're planning to do everything in our power to defend Europe. The immigration, the Islamization, all those problems, it all starts at our borders in the Mediterranean Sea, and it needs to end there.
The World's Richard Hall has been following the story, and you'll recall the reports Rich sent us from the rescue ship he was on last month. Rich, Defend Europe seems to be the opposite from the mission of the ship you were on. Who are they exactly, and what are they up to?
So Defend Europe is a group of activists, essentially, who belong to what they call the Identitarian Movement. Now, that's essentially a network of far-right nativist movements across Europe. They're something like the alt-right movement in the US. They're basically anti-Islam, anti-immigrant, and their biggest concern is stopping immigrants reaching Europe's shores. And they raised $100,000 to charter a ship to monitor the humanitarian rescues that are taking place in the Mediterranean.
Why are they putting the blame on NGOs?
So what they essentially believe is that the presence of these search and rescue missions in the Mediterranean is acting as a pull factor and encouraging migrants to take to the sea to try and reach Europe. So the idea behind that is that migrants think they will be rescued, so more of them will be encouraged to go on these boats. And they also believe that these NGOs are colluding with smugglers and human traffickers to taxi migrants to Europe.
Is there any way to ascertain whether, you know, that dynamic is for real, that the more you rescue people, the more they're likely to come to Europe?
Well, the evidence doesn't really support their case. It's kind of an ongoing debate whether it's push or pull factors that are driving migrants to Europe. So we can look back at the last few years, for example. In 2015, when the EU suspended its rescue missions for the first time, more people than ever attempted the journey and more people drowned. And what happened is smugglers adapted. They sent migrants in more seaworthy wooden boats and people were just being picked up closer to Italy. So more people drowned, but the number of rescue ships didn't really have an impact on migration numbers. So their whole kind of mission is based on this gross simplification of the migrant crisis and the causes behind it.
So what are these far-right nationalists in Defend Europe but planning to do with this boat now that they set sail?
They say that their goal is to document the doings of the NGOs, expose their collaboration with human smugglers, and intervene if they do something illegal. What they're planning to do is to go out into this search and rescue zone and assist the Libyan Coast Guard. And they will pick up migrants and hand them over to the Libyan Coast Guard rather than bring them back to Italy, as other NGOs are doing.
So what are humanitarian rescue ships, like the one you were on, what are they doing to prepare for what will probably be interference in their mission?
So I spoke to a member of the Save the Children staff on the Vos Hestia, which was the boat I was on. They're going to carry on as normal so far, but they did say that this has the potential to put lives in danger. And I asked Rick Govard what he would do if he had a chance to have a conversation with one of these guys, and this is what he told me.
We are not to decide if they are welcome to Europe. The only thing we do is try saving lives at sea. That is not the long-term solution, of course. I think we can all agree. The solution lies on land. We don't get to decide who gets to save. We can help saving lives, and that is our sole mission here.
Well, it sounds like Save the Children and the crew of the Vos Hestia are clear in their mission, but it does sound like it could get messy.
I'm trying to figure out what it would be like with that other boat out there. I mean, these rescues are really chaotic situations. You have people drowning during rescues. Boats can tip over at any time. And all the NGOs out there, they coordinate with each other to make sure that people don't drown. And it's easy to see how another boat out there working to a different end could cause chaos. I mean, when I was on the Vos Hestia, for example, during one of these rescues, we saw the Libyan Coast Guard firing towards a migrant boat with people on it, and it caused people to dive into the water. And these are the people that the Defend Europe guys are trying to work with.
The World's Rich Hall speaking with us from his base in Beirut. We're going to do something now that we don't do often enough. Check back on people we've met during the course of our reporting. Correspondent Jean Carstensen spent a chunk of last year reporting on the refugee crisis in Greece. And since then, she's been tracking the progress of families she met in the camps there. Today, Jean catches up with a Syrian family that was granted asylum in Germany.
I met Ali Doss a year ago at Edomeni refugee camp on the Greek-Macedonia border. One night, I ran alongside him when police fired tear gas during a clash.
Where's your family?
Here, come.
Okay. Are they okay?
Ali and his family have been without a home since 2015 when ISIS invaded their hometown of Palmyra, Syria. Later, in Athens, I met Ali at a museum exhibit about Palmyra's beautiful Greco-Roman ruins, where he used to walk as a boy. He was lamenting everything ISIS destroyed.
We leave a lot of things behind. Memory, story, history. All of this, we leave it behind us.
Ali and his family were desperate to get to Germany to seek asylum. Eventually, they made it. I'm here to see the Doss family at the latest stop on their refugee journey, the small Bavarian town of Traunreut. I find them in good spirits.
Mama make bread here.
She makes bread?
Because if we want Syrian bread, we have to go to another city. There is Arabic shop, but here no, so Mama make bread here.
That's Wissam, Ali's older sister. When the family first arrived in Germany, they were placed in a reception center in Munich for a few weeks, where they could enjoy big city life, buy Syrian food, and hang out with other Syrians.
There is a street in Munich. You walk there, you feel you are in Syria. All people speak Arabic.
But Germany doesn't want to settle all new refugees in urban areas. So newcomers like the Doss family are assigned to locations all over the country. The family is grateful to be safe in Germany. But Traunreut is small and insular, with only a few cafes and shops and minimal street life.
So do you go out at night? Is there anything to do here?
No. There is nothing in this city.
And is it more social in Syria?
Yes, too much. Here there is not. People here, I don't know, kind of cold, maybe because of weather, I don't know. They sit in restaurant, they drink coffee together, but they don't speak.
And what's it like in Syria?
In Syria, you hear the laughing from the end of the street. This is the difference.
When they do go out to shop or do errands, sometimes the locals ignore them.
They don't like us. In this town, I don't know why.
And so what happens? They're just not friendly?
I don't know. They don't like us. If we want to take the bus, they don't stop normally. Yes, if you go to buy something, you say, Dankeschön, and choose, they don't answer.
I wonder how Wissam can laugh at being treated that way. But I imagine keeping a sense of humor could be a useful survival skill. Plus, she understands their discomfort to some degree.
They are just afraid of us. And I can understand if somebody from far place come to my country, it will be strange at the beginning, but after it will be okay.
It's carnival season, so I ask Wissam if she wants to check out the party in the nearby village of Altenmarkt. At 11 a.m., music is blaring from multiple stages, and people are dancing around in costumes, drinking.
What are you drinking?
Glühwein.
And later, beer and the last drinks are schnapps. Grappa.
Glühwein, beer, schnapps and grappa.
Yeah. This is the step by step.
And it's not just adults. Plenty of kids are drinking too. Wissam yells at me over the loud music blaring from another stage. She points out some guys who are dressed up as Saudi sheikhs.
Which one? Saudi Arabia. This guy. Who's wearing white. He's wearing Arab type. He's dressed up like an Arab.
I wonder if she might find Germans dressing up as Arabs while drinking beer insulting. But she really doesn't care. She doesn't mind the alcohol either. As a Muslim, she doesn't drink, but she couldn't care less if others choose to do so. Still, Wissam grew up in another world, in Palmyra, Syria, and she feels like an outsider here.
So what, does this make you happy that you're living in Germany now?
not really, because I'm not part of this.
Back at the refugee center in Traunreut, Ali has arrived and dinner is just about ready.
This is soup and malfour with meat and coffee.
The family's German tutor is also here. Christa Schmidt is one of the few locals the family has struck up a friendly relationship with.
In Deutschland heißt es jetzt guten Appetit.
Ja. In Arabisch Saha. In Arabisch Saha.
Soon, Ali pulls out the shisha. We take turns puffing and talk. Sitting here on the floor after a delicious home-cooked meal, it feels more like I'm in Syria than Germany. I imagine the family is nostalgic for their lost home. Ali expresses a sadness they all feel.
I'm missing to everything in Syria. The house, the widow, the friend, the people, everything.
But I realize it's not really nostalgia. They don't have the luxury to get sentimental. Because the Syria they left behind in Palmyra is gone.
Nobody chose to leave his country. We leave because we're forced to leave. Because it's not safe anymore to stay. So dangerous.
The Doss family is still in limbo in Traunreut. Still living in temporary housing and still lacking a wider community in Germany. But they can imagine that fairly soon, they'll finally have a house of their own. Just a simple place, Ali says.
Like everyone, he wants quiet house and nice life, not more than that.
Even with a house in Germany, I wonder if they will ever feel they belong. I put that question to Wissam.
Can you imagine you'll ever feel German? I mean, will you feel... You probably won't. You'll always be Syrians living in Germany. Or will you someday feel German?
No, Syrian. But maybe my children, they will be... My mother was Syrian. They will forget.
I can feel the Doss family hurtling themselves bravely into their new future in Germany. One way or another, Syria will go with them. For the World, Jean Carstensen, Traunreut, Germany.
Tomorrow, Jean reports on how the German residents of Traunreut are reacting to the arrival of refugees in their town.
Die Flüchtlinge bekommen die Wohnungen, obwohl die hiesigen auch welche bräuchten.
There's a lot of jealousy. People say that the refugees are getting all the apartments, and poor Germans are not.
Jean's reporting on refugees is supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Religion becomes part of the plot on TV's The Bachelorette. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Okay, TV watchers out there, can you recall the last time you saw a Sikh character on primetime television? All right, time.
The last time I remember seeing a Sikh character, it would have been watching The Office in its early seasons when they had a Sikh character who was their IT guy.
That's Kate Shelnut, who writes about religion and pop culture for The Washington Post. Before I go any further, I know there are two pronunciations of the faith, Sikhism and Sikhism. And for the purposes of this conversation, we're going with Sikh and Sikhism. All right. Kate Shelnut at the Post has been keeping her eye on the reality show, The Bachelorette. And in the most recent episode, one of the finalists took The Bachelorette to meet his father. His father is a yogi and convert to Sikhism.
I'm doing my best to make sure she's as prepared as possible, but I haven't seen my father in 2 years, so I'm equally nervous for myself and Rachel walking into the situation.
Kate Shelnut joins me now. So clearly a big deal for Dean, the son of this man who converted to Sikhism. And in TV land, also a pretty big deal?
Yes, there were a few kind of markers here that were pretty unusual. And any Sikh appearance is very unusual. But here we have a man who is a white convert to a faith that originates back in India and Pakistan. So most people who follow the faith, 9 in 10 of them, live in that region. So you're not used to seeing Americans necessarily. And when you do see an American, it's usually a brown person. So here's a white guy, and he's not talking about bias or stereotypes, which is usually the plot line they get pushed into. He's just having some real family moments with his son. Yeah.
A white guy in a long gray beard in a cabin in Colorado, dressed in pink and orange clothes. I mean, it's pretty out there. For those of us who are not Bachelorette regulars, just explain the premise of the show and what's been happening this season.
Sure. So this has been an unusual season, a kind of landmark season for them. They have their first black bachelorette. She had a very diverse cast of suitors, and now they're down to 4 men. And at this point in the series, she goes and meets each of their families. And typically in bachelor history, it's been a very kind of wholesome, here's mom and dad, here's the farm we live in. But this week's bachelorette had some unusual destination. She went to inner city Baltimore. She went down to Florida to meet a Colombian American's mom. And then Dean, who's very young and baby faced and does seem to be that wholesome guy, said, listen, my family is not traditional. And we had learned before that his dad is a widower. And then we go to meet him, and it turns out he's a yogi and kind of has a like spiritual type lifestyle in Colorado. And there was a lot of trepidation because they teased this out. This was the peak tension of the episode.
What's up, Pops?
Hey there, son.
What's up, squad?
Hey!
They're waiting for King Dean to show up.
There was a lot of, I guess, back and forth on whether this was a fair portrayal of Sikhism or if they incorporated the faith as a way for reality TV to up the drama.
Yeah, well, let's dig into that. What was the reaction from fans?
So Sikh fans immediately saw that Dean labeled his father and his family as eccentric and had mentioned that in his interviews beforehand. And they said, listen, are you calling him eccentric because he's a Sikh? And Dean backtracked a bunch on social media. He's very popular. He's a fan favorite. And so he went to Instagram and said, listen, this is not because my dad is a Sikh. We're not close anymore, but I respect this faith, and I hope that the other viewers will respect the faith. But then when the episode itself aired, I feel like he has more mixed feelings than he let on social media. It does seem that he's kind of putting jabs on his dad for a lot of reasons. They have a lot of tension, but his faith, I think, is a part of their tension, and it was really uncomfortable to watch it play out on TV.
And Sikhs, would they prefer to see, I don't know what a more typical Sikh would be, but somebody who is not a convert, who doesn't live in a cabin in rural Colorado, would that be, do they feel, from what you've heard, a better introduction to Sikhism?
I asked that too, and they seemed pretty happy to see a different faith, to show that their faith has ethnic diversity as well, and that Sikhs are human. This man, you might expect kind of a hippy-dippy spiritual peace and blessings, and he certainly did kind of extend that kind of welcome to Rachel and Dean when they came in the house, but he also cursed out his son. He got very, very angry, things that you wouldn't expect from someone who looks like a guru, a yogi, who has this inner peace. And so they said, listen, we're human too. You know, we don't fit even into that perfect happiness, spirituality stereotype. So they liked the idea of a nuanced portrayal. I do think that there might have been a little bit of villainizing or otherizing of a non-Western faith or of a minority faith that might have gone skewed a little bit negative. But overall, they seemed happy at least to have a portrayal that was different.
So does this episode, does this whole trope, does it help our understanding of Sikhism? Is it helping or is it hurting?
The Sikhs that I talk to, it seems like there is a net positive here, even though it was a negative storyline. As we mentioned, it's a way in which people are not used to seeing Sikhs at all. There are people who probably have never encountered a Sikh or heard of a Sikh who watch this show that millions of people watch. So even just seeing their faith at home, they did do meditation around a gong. They did eat vegetarian food. They wear the turban, which is a traditional headgear for Sikhs. So you're seeing some of those details play out. And then you're seeing it in a context that's not just them saying, I'm not a Muslim, which is kind of the line you're used to hearing from Sikhs.
Kate Shelnut writes about religion, women, and pop culture. Kate, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
If you want to find E.T., look to South Africa, where a giant new radio telescope is nearing completion. Here's my BBC colleague, Andrew Harding.
The dishes are assembled on site in what looks like a giant aircraft hangar, and the raw data they collect is processed here too and then sent to headquarters in Cape Town, where telescope operators like Tiani Baloyi are bracing themselves for a tsunami of intergalactic gigabytes.
It's really amazing. It's really huge. It's really huge. It will be like everyone on the planet using the internet at the same time, every second.
Name's Lindsay. Lindsay Magnus, and I look after the operations on the telescope. Traditionally, if you are wanting to make a name for yourself as an international astronomer, you would do your work here in South Africa and collaborate internationally. What we're seeing now is that the rest of the world wants to come to Africa to do their work.
The early signs from the first dishes are fantastically promising. The chief scientist, Fernando Camilo, shows me their first proper scan.
There are about 1,500 galaxies that we can see in this image. The previous best image of this patch of sky, done with a telescope in Australia, showed approximately 70 galaxies. So this is 20 times as many galaxies as the previous best image of this patch of sky.
And that helps bolster the argument that South Africa is making a wise investment here. Naledi Pandor is Minister of Science and Technology.
We had to do some convincing, because there were colleagues in other parts of the world who would say, you know, focus on your poverty problems. What are you doing with this? But we said, this is part of our answer to poverty. You cannot neglect science and believe you'll address, you know, your deepest problems. It's a first.
South Africa's Minister of Science and Technology, Naledi Pandor, ending that report from the BBC's Andrew Harding. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the story of Olive Yang.
She didn't want to be a wife. She didn't want to be married. She didn't want to be a mother.
So instead, Yang became one of the most feared warlords and opium traffickers in Asia's Golden Triangle. That incredible tale, plus how Russia's Vladimir Putin came to love the internet. That's still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Given all the concern about Russia's hacking abilities, you might think of their president, Vladimir Putin, as someone steeped in the dark powers of the web. But Putin's actually a latecomer to the cyber arena. In fact, up until a few years ago, Putin was speaking out loudly against the internet. He called it a CIA project with interests opposed to Russia. Yet, he's come around. Putin's government now seems to be wildly successful at exploiting the web. Russia scholar Richard Lurie has looked closely at how Putin's Kremlin developed an expertise in online espionage. But before we hear about that, here's Lurie on Putin's original medium of choice.
He was basically a television guy. For him, television was the main way he got his news and the main way Russians got their news. 80% of Russians got their news on television. 80% of Russians voted for Putin. So that worked perfectly well for him. Plus, his general mindset and sensibility would incline him to television as opposed to the internet, because it was solid, it was real, it was predictable, it was controllable, it was right there, it was physical and tangible. The internet was vague, it decentralized. Anyone could get anything, anytime, any place. It, to some degree, it's a totalitarian nightmare. It's, by its very nature, democratic, even tending towards the anarchic.
Even TV, though, had a side that Putin didn't like, which was satire, and I guess he just learned to control that. Your chapter on this is actually a riff on the subtitle to Dr. Strangelove, How Putin Learned to Stop Warring and Love the Internet. Did he learn to love it, though, or did he just learn how to control it like he learned how to control TV?
I think love and power for him are fairly closely associated. And if something increases his power and increases his control, as I think I say in the last sentence, how could you not love such a thing? That to him is something that's worthy of admiration, respect, and affection. And also, there are ways of using the internet to discredit people. He did with one of the leading Soviet dissidents who was a critic in the post-Soviet period. He managed to plant child porn on his computer and created a scandal that was exceedingly unpleasant. He realized it was a tool not only of gathering information and expressing opinion, but it had a certain kind of almost lethal quality to it that he appreciated.
How did the whole Edward Snowden affair, leaking the NSA documents and his exile to Moscow, how did that play into Putin's view of the internet?
Well, it showed him how dangerous it could be, and I'm sure that they're terrified of the Russian equivalent of an Edward Snowden appearing. Now, Snowden has been there for a couple of years already, and I believe that Putin is just waiting to use him as a card. You know, Russia doesn't have a lot to offer us in terms of deals. What can they can offer to help us combat ISIS, but that's in their interest as well, probably even maybe more in their immediate interest because they have a 10% Muslim population and they border Muslim countries. But I think that Snowden will be used as a pawn or a present to Trump from Putin at some point when he wants to play that card. If I were Edward Snowden, I'd be exceedingly nervous now.
So Russia, and you referred to this earlier, they've gotten very good at bringing together the internet and what they call kompromat, compromising material, a thing that has a rich tradition in Russian politics. But is that the Kremlin advising Putin on how to do all this, or did Putin figure this out on his own?
He only has 24 hours in his day. He gets good advice. But I think if you're going to hack the American electoral system, that's a major decision. It has to be run by Putin. Lesser things, I don't know, hacking, say, Arizona or Illinois' electoral system, once the go-ahead was given, you wouldn't need permission on every specific point. And interestingly, we can't know too much about this, I think, because of need-to-know principles, but the United States intelligence agencies seem to be claiming that they have confirmation that the hacking of the American electoral system was specifically under the orders of Putin. That means one of two things. Either they intercepted a signal, some kind of electronic communication or telephone communication. That's doubtful that Putin would be that careless, but you don't know. Or there's someone in the inner circle who's giving us firsthand information.
So it seems Putin has mastered the net, but you also argue that the internet, its power and reach, could leave Vladimir Putin vulnerable. Explain that.
The demographics are against Putin in Russia today because the younger people are increasingly, as they are everywhere, getting their news and their views from the internet and not from newspapers or television. The Chinese are good at it, but the Russian internet is still free enough that you can get news, information, and ideas through it without tremendous effort. So ultimately, the hope of Russia is the coming generations who have had no Soviet experience and are increasingly product of the web.
The Russian digital natives.
Yes. It's a mighty force, and it's a unifying force to some degree as much as it's a niche-creating force.
Richard Lurie's new book is Putin, His Downfall and Russia's Coming Crash. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Elections aside, most of us worry that hackers will steal our personal information and credit card numbers. But the real nightmare scenario is hackers taking over, say, a nuclear power plant. Earlier this month, we told you about a joint report urgently released by the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI. They sent it to nuclear facilities and other power plants in the U.S. It warned them that hackers were targeting plants in the U.S. and abroad. Now, weeks later, a document obtained by Vice's technology website, Motherboard, shows the energy sector in the U.K. was likely compromised by hackers. Joseph Cox is with Motherboard and broke the story. Tell us about the document you got a hold of, Joseph, and when this hack probably occurred.
Sure. So this document was distributed among UK government and industry through a sharing platform that GCHQ has, which is the UK's main intelligence agency, the defensive part of that agency. The document just is very similar to the FBI and the Homeland Security one, but it's very specifically about the UK. And most interestingly, it does say that because of the breadth of the attacks and sort of the wide shotgun approach, it is likely that UK energy sector organizations or companies have been compromised by hackers.
And did the report get any more specific than that? Did they say what had been hacked and when it happened?
So the attacks, according to the report, started on around the 8th of June. And then it says that the hackers have targeted engineering, industrial control, energy, the water sector. It does not name any victims, as is quite traditional with these sorts of reports. It also does not name who they suspect is behind the attack, but it does say they are seeing connections to state-sponsored infrastructure. So that is, in other words, hackers that have been hired by someone's government. The report doesn't go into any more detail than that, but a anonymously sourced report that came before mine in the Times of London said the Russian state hackers had targeted the energy sector. It's very likely that my report and the Times report are connected, but we have no evidence personally that Russia was involved, but that is what the Times is reporting themselves.
So what could happen after hackers gain control of a system, let's say of a nuclear power plant? What could occur?
So it's very unclear in this circumstance because the hackers, according to the report, targeted companies and organizations more to do with the supply chain. So that does not necessarily mean power plants themselves. Maybe it's somebody that provides equipment or services for a power plant. At the moment, as the report indicates, a lot of this seems to be espionage, which is, you know, typical between states. Hackers are going to hack and spies are going to spy.
So you suspect, Joseph, that this is more espionage, but isn't trying to hack into industrial control systems way beyond espionage?
I suppose at some point it will cross over or could cross over from espionage into something more kinetic. So eventually they could burrow into critical systems, into power grids, that sort of thing. Not to draw a comparison, but in Ukraine, hackers have repeatedly taken the power out and done much more aggressive attacks on the power grid. But there's no indication that's actually the case here at the moment. From my reading, it more appears to be a quite aggressive scouting operation.
So what's the relationship between the report that came out from DHS and the FBI and the one that you received?
They're very closely related. Not only are the reports closely related, but the hacking attempts in the US and the UK are quite clearly part of the same campaign. They're not just coincidences. They look like they're part of the same hacking campaign.
Joseph Cox with Motherboard, the tech site of Vice. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I spent a couple of days on Cape Cod last weekend, and when you go out to eat in the clam shacks, you hear a whole range of accents from the seasonal foreign waitstaff. This year, though, not so much. Summers are the time of year that businesses in vacation spots like the Cape are dependent on the H-2B visa. It's for seasonal workers, mostly in fisheries and landscaping and at resorts. Yesterday, officials in Washington announced a one-time bump in the number of H-2Bs for this year. Maybe that'll give a little relief to those workers who've been doing double duty. But as Amy Bracken reports from Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, that news comes too late for some employers who have already been through a punishing summer.
Business is booming at the Homeport restaurant on Martha's Vineyard. The place is packed, and there's a long line for seafood takeout. But the restaurant's co-owner, Sarah Nixon, isn't celebrating.
It's really rough.
Rough because it isn't always easy hiring a dedicated summer staff. And this summer, it's worse than usual.
We aren't opening for lunch at the moment. We're closing 2 days a week for dinner. I've never had to do that before.
Normally, Nixon has a full summer staff, vetted, experienced, and largely from Jamaica. They built a niche here, coming back each summer. Jamaicans are among the top H-2B visa holders in the U.S. The visas are capped at $66,000 a year, But often, in the past, that cap didn't apply to returning visa holders, so Nixon's workers could come back each summer. Congress ended that exemption last fall, meaning this year Nixon had to compete for the visas along with everyone else, and they were all snapped up by the time she began hiring. Same for Nancy's restaurant, another popular seafood spot on the island. The manager, David Gaffey, says they're down 10 workers this summer, mostly cooks from Jamaica who've worked here for years.
I mean, it's huge, because all the other employees are working full-time as it is, so that's a big deficit. There's no people around here that are qualified to fill those positions, so it's not an ideal scenario.
Businesses have lobbied for more visas, but without much progress. This week, the government increased the cap by 15,000, which is less than requested, and it required businesses to show, quote, irreparable harm if they didn't get the visas. Meanwhile, some critics say these employers don't do enough to hire American workers, and others say the visa program is rife with abuses, such as wage theft and forced labor. Daniel Costa is with the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute.
I think generally increasing the number of workers in a program that is this flawed doesn't make a lot of sense. I think that DHS and DOL should focus on fixing the program and making sure that there are more worker protections in place.
Some safeguards are in place now. Employers must run job ads in local papers before hiring guest workers, and they have to pay a prevailing wage. But Costa says the safeguards aren't bulletproof. Business owners here also want reforms, an easing of the cap, and consistency from year to year.
Hello, may I please have one of your plain chocolate and also a bag of the mix of caramel?
This year, Mike McCourt is one of the lucky ones. He owns Murdoch's Fudge and has three shops on the vineyard. He got all 14 visas he'd applied for his summer workers.
They're the ones that open the stores, and they're the ones that close the stores. They know all aspects of the business. So when I open up in the spring, it's like having a full-time staff, and they just come in and take over where they left off.
He says there simply aren't enough local adults available and willing to do these jobs year after year. Many businesses here hire students, but say they sometimes skip work to hit the beach. Lorna Bennett is a visa holder from Jamaica who works at the Fudge Shop. She says she read that some businesses in the U.S. were forced to close because they couldn't get H-2B visas, and she can see why.
For the most part, when we come, we work very hard because that's what we're here to do. We're here to work. We don't hang around. We don't sit around. We just work.
Bennett has worked here for the past three summers and often works a second job at a bakery. Many H-2B holders do that, clocking more than 80 hours a week. And because visa holders work multiple jobs, Sarah Nixon, the restaurant owner, says there's a ripple effect when those visas are in short supply.
People keep coming up to me and say, hey, where's Junior? He usually works for me in the morning at the fish market at 4 a.m. before he starts with you. Well, he's not here. You know, where is Marva? She usually comes and cleans my house. Well, Marva's not here. She's in Jamaica with no job.
And they won't be here this season, despite this week's increase in the visa cap. They can only hope another decision will come out of Washington soon on whether they can come back next year. For The World, Amy Bracken, Martha's Vineyard.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. There's a picture of a young Olive Yang back in the 1950s. She's surrounded by her soldiers in what was then Burma. The soldiers, all men in uniform, stand at attention. She's out in front, clearly in charge, with a cigarette dangling from her fingers, and she's dressed like a man. Yup, Olive Yang was a badass before that was even a word. She was also a warlord and opium trafficker in the Golden Triangle of Southeast Asia. Oh, and she once had a romance with one of Burma's most famous actresses. Complicated character, right? Last week, Olive Yang died at the age of 90. We're going to remember her with help from reporter Gabrielle Palouch. She had the opportunity to meet Olive and interview her a couple of years ago.
Olive was in a wheelchair in her pajamas with her short cropped haircut, and I'd been reading about her for so long and was so excited to see her. But she had suffered a fairly severe stroke just a couple months prior, so it was really difficult to talk to her, and she wasn't even really able to speak that much. But I did get some audio recordings of the few words she said to me. And when I showed her photos of Wawa Wenchui, the actress that she seduced, she laughed heartily and she said, yeah, Wawa Wenchui. So she was really excited to see that photo.
So take us back to all of Yang's early years. This is the 1920s when she was a girl in British Burma, now Myanmar. She came from royal stock, right?
Yeah, so they are descended from Chinese royalty, and they wound up in the Golden Triangle in the early 19th century. It was a small territory called Kokang, and she always was unusual as a child. She was described as being very unusual and very boyish. She got in trouble for bringing guns in her backpack to school, or she would fall in love with her brother's girlfriends or her brother's wives. Her inability to conform to the gender roles that were expected from her were sort of constantly messing her up. Mm. And eventually, her parents got so frustrated that they arranged for her to marry a cousin, hoping that would calm her down. And in the end, that decision might have prompted her to go pursue a career as an opium trafficker, because she didn't want to be a wife, she didn't want to be married, she didn't want to be a mother, and it left her with very few options.
Later in life, she asked to be called Uncle Olive. Is she the appropriate pronoun to be using here? Because there's some confusion as to whether Olive Yang actually identified as transgender, or culturally whether there was even a word for that.
Right. I mean, it's really difficult to know, because in the Golden Triangle in 1927, words like genderqueer or transgender, all these terms that we have today, simply didn't exist. And if you keep in mind that Olive's native language, which is a Kokang Chinese dialect, doesn't even use gendered pronouns, it might not have really come up that much linguistically. She might not have ever had to really identify herself in that way. There's a lot of things that she did that aren't quite captured by words like gay or cross-dressing. But it doesn't really seem right to refer to her as transgender, because she never referred to herself as such. Mm. And we can't ask her that.
So she spent some time in jail and obviously couldn't be helped. She left her children behind. How did her relationships with her kids suffer?
Naturally, Olive's relationship with her son is a complicated one. He's the product of marital rape, and she gave him up as soon as he was born to a wet nurse and didn't want to raise him because she wanted to be working on the border trafficking opium. And when Jeep was born, he, you know, spent a lot of time with his uncles. He rarely saw his mother, and they haven't spoken in over a decade. He looks exactly like his mother and says that whenever he misses her, he just looks in the mirror to remind himself of her. So it's obvious that there's a longing there and there's a sadness there. There was not much mothering or parenting going on from Olive's side, but her son loves her deeply and thinks of her often and told me that he has no ill feelings towards her and understands that her life was very complicated and that she had to do what she had to do.
You know, Gabrielle, the Golden Triangle seems like a kind of place where these larger-than-life characters just breed. There were those cigar-smoking child twins who led what they called God's Army. That fed the tropes in films like Tropic Thunder. And there's Olive Yang. What is it about the Golden Triangle that gives us these colorful people, do you think?
The Golden Triangle is a special sort of place because it's this lawless land where so many different groups with so many different interests are competing. I personally think that Olive Yang is the best character out of the Golden Triangle and thinks she's absolutely fascinating and such a pioneer in unselfconscious ways. She had no idea that her struggle with her gender or the way she defied Burmese authorities would inspire so many people or would somehow make her into a hero of sorts.
Reporter Gabrielle Palouk, thanks very much for introducing us to Olive Yang and filling us in on her story. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Marco. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
Yeah, radio has a way of connecting us to stories and people we wouldn't otherwise know about. And I'm not just saying that because I've got some hidden agenda. I'm actually thinking of a groundbreaking event that happened on the radio 60 years ago this week when the BBC launched its Somali service. Back in July 1957, Somalia still would not have independence for another 3 years, but this new radio service gave Somalis an early taste of what national unity would be like.
Halkani waa London oo idin kala hadlaysa laba muujidood oo gaaban 12ka iyo 13ka.
The service also became invaluable for Somalis outside their country, longing for the culture and language of home. And that's still true, says the BBC's Baskash Jugsodai.
That is the language that has been connecting the people of Somalia for the last 60 years with the rest of the world, wherever the Somalis are. You remember that 1990s, the country went into civil war. And after that, you know, the Somalis were scattered all over the, you know, this world. You'll find them anywhere. You go to a village in China, you will find a Somali who wants to know what's happening in Somalia and what's happening in the Somalis who are in Minnesota in America. And that is the channel that they have been using. You will find Somalis in the, you know, looking after their animals, listening to BBC Somali service religiously. When I say religiously, I mean by the fact that, you know, the Somalis will stop anything they are doing to listen to BBC Somali service.
Today, with Al-Shabaab extremists a constant threat in Somalia, the BBC Somali service plays as big a role as it ever has, connecting Somalis around the globe and sharing the good stuff in Somali life, like music. I hope my colleagues at the Somali service know about this. But later this summer, there's a great CD coming out called Sweet as Broken Dates, Lost Somali Tapes from the Horn of Africa. It'd be perfect for the Somali service celebrations this week. Anyway, we leave you with one track. This is the Sharero Band featuring Fadumo Kasim. And we'll have more of this sweet album when the CD officially comes out next month. That's where we say goodbye to y'all today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.